Yeah, that's exciting. And the
Yeah.
people that listen to optimists like yourself, it's a different constituents than other audiences. And my own belief, while I still come to terms with how to optimally communicate, I do believe this, that it's there should be a range of communication because there are different constituents with different interests, with different priorities, interested in focusing on different aspects of the issues. If you're going to Congress, you're interested in economics over, ideally for the time horizon of their own term, if we're to be realistic, which is hard because this is a long-term investment. And I really appreciate your going into detail about the protocol because this is exactly the kind of dialogue that helps people who are listening to the milieu of different perspectives, put it all in perspective. Something that it made me think about was an article you wrote, Gerontologist in the Media, The Dangers of Over-Pessimism. You concluded there with a few points. There's no clear moral, social, or political argument against such technology, and that it's a legitimate aspiration. So if they're interested in a product, they want to know the delivery date, right? Or at least the best estimate, even if it can't be defined in more than probabilistic terms. Something that I think about as someone who has been a collator of information, how does one go about modeling or estimating and knowing that it's and ensuring that it is a sort of a responsible articulation? Part of it is certainly probability, but when I was doing my PhD, I have a PhD in health services
Oh,
research, where I was
wow.
going with the background is one of the things I did a little bit of. I played around with Markov models and some mathematical modeling to come up with estimates using multiple different studies and data, different data points from different data sources to try to model and then sensitivity test. Like within what range might be a reasonable estimate? What is your current LEV thoughts, probabilistic and time
So,
horizon?
yeah, so my current estimate is that we have a 50-50 chance of reaching longevity escape velocity within 12 to 15 years from now. What has not changed is the variance that I put on that. I've always said that I think we've got at least a 10% chance of not getting there for 100 years just because of the possibility of all manner of obstacles that we haven't thought of yet that we might encounter. And I haven't changed that. That I still say, we've got to realistically say there's a 10% chance that we won't get there for 100 years. I always like to make sure that people don't think I'm just looking at the problem in terms of like people saying that powered flight was theoretically impossible right up until somebody did it,
Yeah,
because
I like that example.
I always think powered flight is a good example of this, because there are cases like that where experts were unjustifiably over-pessimistic. But in that same example, there were experts who were unjustifiably over-optimistic, the most obvious one being Leonardo da Vinci, who I'm fairly sure did not think it was going to take like 400 years to get his designs to work.
But the
So,
point is, he and others kept trying.
well, that's right, exactly it. And when people in the field complain, well, they say, oh, we mustn't overpromise, and we mustn't say anything. An example I like to highlight is the war on cancer. So it's clear that 50 years ago, when Nixon decided to put proper money into the National Cancer Institute, two things happened. Number one, that happened because the expert community was making timeframe predictions. They were saying they reckon they could bring cancer essentially under control within 10 years. Now, if we look back even a little bit later, actually, even like 10 years after that, and we look back at why they were saying it, I honestly can't imagine why they were saying it. It seems like obvious nonsense to me. But you had to be there to understand what the experts were going to say. So I'm not saying that necessarily was nonsense. However, the point is, it wouldn't have happened if they hadn't had timeframes in what they were saying. And then if we ask, what are the consequences of having made such pitifully slow progress as compared to what was predicted, the answer is nothing at all. There hasn't been a single year when the US government has reduced the budget of the National Cancer Institute. And for sure and certain, a great deal of progress has been made against cancer, or not nearly enough, but a great deal more than what would have been made if the war on cancer had not happened. So, not to take that as the precedent is, to my mind, deeply irresponsible.
It's only by shooting for the moon that we start the space program. Essentially, we need to have a goal, and it sounds like this was kind of a gestalt. Moore's law is some basis for rationale, and the reality is when you're talking about things that are unprecedented, and you're taking an engineering approach where you're thinking more about the tools at the disposal, and it would be something fundamental. It's not like you know, we'll just flap our wings and that will fly, but it's more like we'll take these kind of approaches, we'll do these kind of damage reduction approaches. We don't have the enough data points really to have a model beyond our best intuition, and we need to have some starting point, as you see it, so we can have a goal, so we could make progress in that direction. And the proof is in the pudding that not only globally across geoscience, but very excitingly in damage control, we've made phenomenal progress. And is there any way do you feel that we are able to answer the question in hindsight, the question of optimal communication with the media? I think it's one of those things, we don't have enough data points. We don't have a control to the experiment of life, so we can rationalize it. But I wonder, is there some litmus test we can use retrospectively,
really,
in absence
really.
Of a control?
I think the right way to do this is to say what you believe and be ready to defend what you're saying, you know, in as much detail as you're asked to. Some journalists are smarter than others, and in particular, some journalists have smarter audiences than others. So you're always going to have a chance, especially if you're a reasonably high-profile expert like me and you're doing interviews every other day, you're always going to have a chance to get the full breadth of your of what you're trying to say out there in language that the various audiences will understand if they want to. The problem is not lack of knowledge. The problem is not lack of respect for experts. The problem is the pro-aging trance. In other words, the psychological need of so many of humanity to put aging out of their mind and pretend and trick themselves into thinking that it's a blessing in disguise so that they don't have to think about it and they can just get on with their miserably short lives.
I agree with you wholeheartedly about yeah. that. I love that expression okay. you coined.
So in the this really brings me to the other part of your previous question, actually, which is how do I get to these estimates in the first place? Because you put your finger on it, really. The way one does this, as an expert in any field, certainly as an expert in any pioneering technological field, is almost entirely subjective. It's a matter of looking at the body of stuff that I actually know about, you know, what the goal is, where we are right now, and how rapidly we're moving, and just kind of putting my finger in the air and aggregating it, subjectively. That's the source of most of this enormous variance that I mentioned, right? Because I know that there's an enormous amount that I don't know about that. But still, having been a scientist for quite a long time and having worked with other scientists of a variety of different types for quite a long time, you know, one inevitably does get some degree of sense of proportion of how difficult a problem is. If one couldn't do that, then one would never be able to give realistically difficult problems to one's grad students, right? So it's not just me being supposedly having some oracle. It's what any senior scientist does.
And you've made several points. Of course, you had to, because I've had several questions embedded in one. But I do see value in articulating concrete, specific aspirations. And insofar as we're able to be sincere about our outlook, and I think our field benefits, I think it benefits from everybody. There are individuals at both ends of the spectrum and how they communicate that I have very high respect for. And I believe it's really authenticity and saying what you know and justifying it that helps foster a very eclectic group of supporters and help create the movement, including at the grassroots, which really you have a great forte to. You have a kind of, there's a kind of gravity towards a philosophy, there's like a unifying philosophy or set of philosophies behind what you apply your models as a thought leader to. I wonder, for these different audiences, a lot of people follow me are, also tread similar paths as follow you. For example, people who are cryptocurrency, people who are involved in the DAOs, individuals who are very much technology enthusiasts, aficionados of Ray Kurzweil's reading, those who are unconventional thinkers in many ways and are futurists, if you will. A major force in Project 49, which is the code name for turning 49 years old and then deciding I'm too passionate about the longevity space to not find other ways to interface with it besides being an anonymous little emoji on Twitter. One of the things that motivated me to get out is that I could potentially coach and consult in the longevity science guided health coaching and consultation. I'm thinking about of those few individuals I'll take on, they're going to turn to me and they're going to say, Dr. Barzal, they're going to say David, because I won't be acting the capacity for physician, but as a coach and consultant who does not diagnose or treat and does not prescribe, but can look at the literature and talk, they're going to say, Mr. Barzal or David, they're going to say, what's your advice to me? I follow Aubrey de Grey. I want to make an impact in this field. I have some knowledge and expertise, but what concrete steps can I take to help bring us closer to a future where, I'll use more conservative language here, but I'll say a future where our health span is extended as much as possible.
Yeah. Healthy longevity. So people come to me and ask me that question all the time, of course. If they come and they say, what supplements should I take or what diet or whatever, then I never give the answer they want because, first of all, because I'm a PhD and not an MD, so I'm not really even allowed to give recommendations like that, but also because nothing that we have today works, or at least only very slightly, and different things work slightly for different people. And so it's really, not the way to be thinking. The way to be thinking is how not how to extend one's own life with what we have today, but rather how to hasten the arrival of things that we don't have today, and thus the probability that one will have access to them before it's too late. And then we come to the part of what you just said that matters the most, namely different people have very different expertise, different predilections, different circumstances, different track record, and so on. And so whenever anyone comes to me and they ask me that kind of question and I've got past the, supplements part, I will ask them a lot of questions about themselves, even for someone who wants to invest, for example. If I've tried to get them to donate and they've said no, they want to make money, then that's not the end of the story for me, even though I lead a nonprofit. Because there are plenty of people in the private sector that could benefit from some investment. So I'll ask, the questions you would imagine. I'll ask, what ticket size do you want to write? I'll ask, how much risk appetite do you have? Do you want to lead an investment round, or do you want to follow people who are more experienced in the field than you are? Things like that. And I did that, I've been doing that for a long time now, not just with investors, with every kind of person who comes to me. And that's fine, but it doesn't scale. There's only so much that one person can do, even though I, obviously have a very big network of people to introduce people to and so on. I do a lot of that. So right now we are in the position, I'm delighted to say, where it doesn't all depend on me. In particular, there's one organization that I was delighted to be able to seed fund a year or so ago. It's called Less Death. And it's...
They have T-shirts too, I believe.
I'm sorry?
I believe they have T-shirts too. Either maybe I'm imagining that, but
no, you're not imagining it. They have T-shirts. They run retreats, a few retreats each year, where they bring maybe 50 people like that together, and they teach them stuff. There are mentors who give talks and so on, but also, of course, they meet each other and they form alliances and collaborations and so on. And they've done a few of these retreats now. It's been spectacularly successful. It takes the heat off me to a great extent, but the main thing is, it's definitely something that can scale. So I'm really delighted at that.
Yes. And what are your thoughts in terms of there is the RadFest, an enterprise like that? What would be your advice to people in that space? Because it's a very eclectic group of individuals that go there. And I think their command of the good science and the bad science is quite variable among the attendees there. Mm-hmm. I think it's great to see a lot of energy and enthusiasm within the community for a concept of working together towards addressing healthy longevity and, you know, life extension, all of these things. What's your advice or suggestions to organizers of groups involved in that to make it optimally constructive towards meaningful contributions in the direction that they desire?
Yeah, so the answer is surprisingly similar to the answer I gave to your previous question. You know, when I started out running my own conferences, which was back in 2003, mine were the only conferences that really focused on doing something about aging, as opposed to kind of understanding aging as a phenomenon, you know, in a curiosity-driven kind of way. And even my conferences only happened every alternate year. So, you know, now there's one of those things every month. And of course, I do still run my own in Dublin. The series happened. In fact, we just are in the process of announcing today the new, the 2034 conference, which will be on June the 13th through 16th in Dublin. And that's all wonderful, but it is a source of great pleasure to me that there are so many other conferences, because I don't regard those ones as competing with mine, not at all. They each have their own, you know, character, and they appeal to different audiences, not just because they're in different locations around the world, but because they have, you know, different selections of speakers, different selections of delegates. The Radfest is quite a distinctive one in the sense that it kind of brings together people, you know, very good, perfectly good science, together with a great deal of passion. People who come from an unscientific background, and they've just got excited about the idea of not dying and preferably not getting sick either. You know, so I wrote an editorial about it, actually, in Rejuvenation Research several years ago, saying, you know, this is the first time that people have succeeded in bringing passion and pragmatism together in the same under the same roof.